Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Now, today we talk with BitKiwi Paul, and we do a bit of a retrospective on the most recent BitKiwi meetup in Wellington, how it went, what we learned, and what we're looking forward to for the next upcoming BitKiwi event down in Christchurch next month. We also dive into just some of my experiences investigating AML and KYC regulations here in New Zealand, and sort of seeing how that sausage gets made, and then also a bit of a dive into how rural people understand Bitcoin, just having gone recently back to Hawke's Bay to help out with some flooding in my hometown, and just sort of getting a bit of a reminder of just what value means in the real world. So it was a great catch-up. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you'd like to support the show, please consider streaming some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show. BitKiwi Paul, welcome back.
Good to be here.
We've had a couple of weeks since BitKiwi 3 here in Wellington, and I wanted to catch up with you and sort of debrief on how it went, the successes, kind of what has evolved for you and the BitKiwi crew, having done a couple of these events now. I mean, give me your take on how BitKiwi went this time around.
This time around, it was awesome. Had a great time. I really enjoyed talking with the people that were there. We anticipated slightly lower numbers because BitKiwi 2, we had some people traveling from South Island. And we knew that they'll be holding back for BitKiwi 4, most probably. So we expected slightly lower numbers, which we did get, slightly lower than BitKiwi 2, but still good. And I was impressed by the chat this time, actually. There was really good Bitcoin discussion, although that might be a bit of a personal thing, because the first two were so focused on making sure things were running and happening that I didn't actually stop to talk much Bitcoin with anybody, whereas this time I really got around and did talk to people, and I was really impressed by the knowledge of some of the people that hadn't been before. And some of the technical chat was really awesome. And what I love most about it is so many people were just happy that there is something. Like, you get people turning up and just like, oh man, I'm just so stoked that there's Bitcoin is getting together somewhere. So that makes you feel really good, obviously. And there was a lot of Satoshis passed through the system this time. So it was the highest amount of drinks brought out of all the BitKiwis, despite slightly less than the BitKiwi before. So people love engaging with the Lightning Network and just doing that, which is really awesome.
Yeah, I think it was very well organized. I mean, having the ability to buy drinks with sats and the way you facilitated that in a way that the bar and the venue itself didn't have to deal with any of that. You sort of took that on and provided that interface so that Bitcoiners could come, scan a QR code, and then they were able to go and get a drink at the bar without necessarily having to involve the bar in that process. I thought that was really a nice, clean way of doing it. I mean, ideally, the dream would be to get the bar accepting Lightning themselves, but it's important, I think, and I think this is what you've done really well, is to build up to that kind of approach. You know, you can't just come in on day one and expect a venue to accept Lightning. You know, you have to sort of work your way up to it. And I think you also had the Bitcoin magazine for sale as well.
Yeah, so that was a big highlight. As we got some contacts through, there's a Kiwi, Andrew Cummins, shout out, who works for Bitcoin Magazine. We got in touch with him. He put us in touch with someone else. We managed to get a bit of a deal through Bitcoin Magazine to get them to New Zealand, because we'd seen for ourselves that it's just actually really hard to get them here. If you were to buy a single Bitcoin Magazine through the website online and get it shipped here, you're paying $100 New Zealand. So it's just really quite difficult and out of reach. So we managed to make a sort of a deal with them to get it here and be able to offer it at a more reasonable price. I mean, it's still a good price for a magazine, but it's comparable to just the flat price online. So we really did our best with that, and it was really cool. So a few people brought them and all paid Bitcoin, which was really awesome to get that going. Hopefully we'll be able to offer those at future meetups.
Yeah, and so BitKiwi now is the exclusive provider of Bitcoin Magazine's distributor, would you say, or what's
I think you could say that. I don't think we're contractually exclusive.
Okay.
So we don't have a contract with Bitcoin Magazine to say that nobody else in New Zealand can supply them or anything like that.
You are the only distributor at the moment.
I believe so. Yeah, we've done quite a bit of searching around, and I'm pretty 99.9% confident nobody else is selling it in the country.
Yeah. No, certainly it's. I think having the ability to order it locally, and I mean you'd get it all in. And then you're able to send it out, and people aren't having to pay that, you know, insane international shipping on all of their orders. I think that's really cool. And I brought one myself as well. I'm going to probably grab another one as well, just to keep, you know, keep that one, in the cover, and then have one for reading.
Because they are a little bit collectible compared to your average magazine. I know their website, they sell past issues for pretty extortionate prices. So they are seen as quite a lot of scarcity there, classic Bitcoin stuff coming in. And the latest edition also comes with that. They've done that little thing with the dollar bill with Bukele on it.
Bukele bucks.
Yeah. And they've embossed them with individual numbers to try and get a real collectible thing going. So you get one of those in each the current issue that we're selling anyway. There is a new issue now out, but it's not yet available. But we are looking to get that hopefully in time for BitKiwi 4. We'll see how we go.
Yeah. So if people want to order Bitcoin Magazine from BitKiwi, what's the best way for them to do that? Just jump on your Twitter, and I think you have a link to the details
Yeah, feel free to DM us or just tweet at us and we'll get in touch. Otherwise, we have set up an email address, bitcoinmagazine@bitkiwi.co.nz. So if you email that, we'll send you an invoice straight back. And best way to pay is Lightning. So it's basically 10% less than if you pay with fiat, and you'll get a quicker shipping because we'll get the instant settlement of that invoice, so we won't have to wait overnight, so we'll get that in the post straight away.
Yeah, I love it. No, I really enjoyed the meetup. There was a lot of good conversation, and seeing people sort of gravitate towards paying with Lightning and seeing that sort of process unfold before your eyes is really quite cool.
Bitcoiners love it because you just don't get the opportunities that much. So we're trying to expand that and provide as much as we can. So we're always thinking of new ideas and see what we can do at next meetups. But yeah, most definitely, it's just cool seeing people use Lightning and they love it.
Yeah, no, Lightning's incredible. And I think by my count, well, did you have a count on how many people came through?
I think there was I counted at maximum, I think there was about 22 or so at any one time. Some people came and left and some people came late. So I think BitKiwi 2, there was about 35, so slightly less than that.
I agree with you though. I think a lot of the South Island people will be coming to BitKiwi 4, which is next month. What's the date on that?
So March 25th. 2 p.m. at the Bealey Quarter in Christchurch, Bealey Avenue, I think it is.
Yeah.
Not an experienced Christchurch traveller, but did a lot of work trying to find a venue that would sort of fit in the same way that we do it in Wellington, and this one seems to fit, and they seem happy to have us. Yeah, so see how it goes.
Wow, excellent. Yeah, I'll be going down. I brought my tickets.
Nice.
So I'll see you there, and it'll be good to catch up with a few of the guys who I haven't seen since last year. And I know there's certainly a lot of Bitcoiners floating around in Christchurch because just before BitKiwi 3 the other week, I caught up with HG, who we did an episode with just before we came over to the meetup. And, you know, there's really a scene down in Christchurch, you know?
I've got a feeling about it. There's a few guys there. I know they're having their own occasional meetups and things and doing things. And they've found that the Cambodian restaurant that accepts Bitcoin that they like to go to, which is awesome. It does feel like there's a scene down there. I feel like there's a bit of activity on our Twitter from South Islanders, because I know there's Rob in Queenstown, Brandon in Dunedin, and I think I haven't double checked, but I think they might both be travelling up for it. I'm pretty sure Brandon is. I haven't actually checked with Rob, but there's a few around the South Island hopefully that can get to Christchurch. There's a nice little centre there to get them.
Well, one of the other interesting conversations of many that were had at BitKiwi 3, I was talking to a kind of an ex-farmer type who came down from Hawke's Bay. And, I sort of grew up in the countryside, so I sort of have an affinity for that that way of thinking. And I haven't gone back recently just to help out with some of the flooding in Hawke's Bay. I've come to really realize, I don't know, the way rural people sort of understand value, the way they see things, it really kind of fits. And I've had a few other data points that support this idea that I think people who are working with the land, people who work with agriculture, farming, that sort of thing, I feel like they're a lot more able to understand what Bitcoin means in a way that you maybe would more easily dismiss if you're in the city or a digital kind of white collar worker. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Definitely. And you can see that in Bitcoin. It does fit because I can see a connection there where the farmers are providing food directly. So what they're doing every day is hands-on actual value in their hands of what they're getting to people. And, you know, us white-collar workers in the city and whatnot, you know, we're outsourcing all of that stuff. We're picking up our meat at the supermarket. We're just using outsourcing to get all that value. We're not directly doing that. So maybe we're not having quite got that physical connection with things. So I do feel like it resonates with the farmer when they are creating direct value and then receiving or exchanging value, direct value like Bitcoin, rather than a middleman in the fiat system.
Well, it's interesting because even though it's digital, it's physical in the sense that it is a kind of a tangible thing. Like I think that's what this individual that I was talking to, and it was a great conversation. I think we were sharing that conversation together, but like the way the farmer sees, say, a plot, you know, a piece of land, like fallow land that hasn't got anything on it, you know, you don't, it's not worthless just because it hasn't got anything on it. You know, there's no crops or anything. It's like, it's all about the potential value. And so if you go around measuring the value of a farm day by day, it's kind of like the same as looking at the price of Bitcoin. It goes up, it goes down. Like it doesn't really matter. You know, it's what the long-term value of that thing is. And that really sort of struck me as quite an interesting way to look at it. Because I think one of the questions that always, I wouldn't say bothers me, but I always come up against is this question of volatility. People say, well, it's great, I understand that the proposition that you're suggesting, but because of the volatility, I don't see it ever being used as a currency or anything. And I always say to them, well, look, you know, by the time the volatility is ironed out, it's going to have already won, and you either have it or you don't, and you kind of have to ride that wave. But taking kind of that, the way you'd look at, say, like a piece of land is like, yeah, there's work that needs to be done. There's proof of work to develop that land. When it's fallow and it's empty and it's autumn and there's nothing there, that's not to say that that land is worthless. It just needs a bit more time. And for us, it's 4 years at a time. For a farmer, it's the season. But that kind of way of thinking, I think, comes through for both the farmers and the Bitcoiners in an interesting way.
And you're seeing it catch on with this whole beef initiative and all these kinds of things overseas. You can see that it actually is resonating with that particular culture and area. But it's interesting what you were just saying there about volatility. And I mean, that's such a common statement. But again, that's just, I mean, you can just talk about that for a second. Like, you think about, like, it was good comparing it with land. I like that. And also you think again, I so often come back to the internet with Bitcoin, but you know, internet is revolutionized communication. If you had said to someone, this is going to be the primary medium of communication back in like 1990, they'd be like, well, the connection is volatile. Like, how, I can't rely on this dial-up connection. This could happen, that could happen, the phone line goes down. We can't have a primary method of communication that is this unreliable. Like, it's really a very similar kind of argument. Volatility is a sign of the earliness, and in the long term, I just don't see that as any kind of issue at all.
Yeah, and I think it's almost flipping it. It's like, once you're on a Bitcoin standard, which is certainly where I am at, it's like I see it more like, yeah, 100 sats here, 1,000 sats there is not a lot in dollar terms, but it's certainly a lot in 10 years from now. And that thinking is, I mean, it feeds into everything we always talk about, but it's like you start to plan things differently and it starts to change your outlook. And that was another learning that I had just helping out with this flood recovery in Hawke's Bay, looking at, you know, just, I mean, it was in, you know, my family's place in a rural area, and, you know, there's the water's came up, it's about a meter of water and about half a meter came through the house. And looking at how we were able to basically use what was around us to instantly salvage the house and kind of do the recovery in a way that we couldn't have done if it was a city or you didn't have any of that stuff. And so what I mean is, you know, we had generators, we had tools, we had a freezer of food and meat and a few other things, so that basically as soon as my brother and me arrived, we were able to get to work and start cleaning up the house and kind of do the proof of work. And there was all of this equipment lying around that we were able to instantly redeem the value from. And this is where I was like trying to just sort of articulate this, because in the countryside, people really, you know, like a chainsaw or, you know, a load of firewood or whatever it might be, like the physical thing actually is the medium of exchange. And you see this quite a lot. You know, it's like, you know, you drop a load of firewood off, you get a load of meat. You know, you exchange a chainsaw for an air compressor. These kinds of barter type scenarios. And, you know, sometimes there's money involved, but often it's like that direct exchange. And it's so close to the land, though, that like I just look at the way, you know, the old man sort of has chainsaws and stuff. You know, and I was like, oh, man, you got too much junk. But it's like when it actually was needed, it was like we redeemed it. You know?
Well, that kind of barter and trade, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine now, but in an ideal world, that's all you'd need. Like, you know, we only needed a medium of exchange because you've got something really small and you want something really big and you can't produce enough of those small things. You've got to think of another way to exchange that value. I mean, that's the only purpose of money, really, in the beginning. It was just because trading was imperfect or seasonal.
Yeah, and you've got the double coincidence of wants where, you know, I want this thing, but you're not doing that thing. And so by using money, we can kind of intermediate that, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of the basis of money. But I do think in the countryside, in particular, though, there are common agreed things. And like for us, you know, historically, like rice in other places has served, you know, like food, you know, grains and other kind of food.
Salt as well.
Yeah. And that's commodity money, right? And in the countryside, it's like, yeah, firewood, meat, tools, vehicles, things like this, actually, like they hold their value. And so like a diesel truck is like, you know, that's a thing, that's a unit, a store of value. A chainsaw is a store of value. You know, old man pine, you know, firewood is a store of value. All of these things for country folk, actually, like it instantly makes sense, and they just see the value. And I don't know, just experiencing that firsthand and seeing the instant redeemability of that value, in the sense it's like, okay, we've got a fallen tree due to the flooding, we have a chainsaw, we instantly redeem its utility in a way that it's like paper money is absolutely useless in that situation.
And if it was all gone, you could live.
And
like, it's not like you need that.
And I mean, the old man, he lost his wallet because the car got washed away, and so he didn't even have money. And so for like 4 days we were, you know, we were off, and there was no power. There's not really much internet, you know, cell phone coverage. And so literally every exchange we made for like 3 or 4 days was like in the old style, and it seemed totally natural. And it was also because the other thing I was looking at is just how goodwill and community came into it, which was the people who came and helped out, because the neighbors didn't get flooded out, so they were able to give them some help, gave them a, you know, a bus to sleep in and a few other things just while we cleaned up. And it was like, wow, you know, and that was based on goodwill and favors that had been done previous and kind of future favors, you know. And that's kind of like, I don't know, there's something about that kind of community.
It's interesting you say that, because I once read a lot of stuff about this sort of thing where, even though it was a terrible disaster and horrible things that happened to people's homes and some people died and whatnot, I'd hazard a guess that at the end of it, you felt really good. Like, this had been a really positive, nice experience.
Yeah.
And it's actually kind of the natural human condition, right? Like, where you are in a community where you are helping each other and you're surviving. Instead, now we're in this sort of pampered world where we're more than surviving. We're just like, what's going to make us happy? And there was I know after like World War II, for example, there was a lot of study done on how people felt after these disasters, terrible things. And when they bedded down in the underground tube stations for the bombings, most of the people reported it as a positive experience. Like, they banded together and they divvied up jobs and they were helping the community. And a lot of them reported that after it was over, if they went home, if they had a home, they missed it and they enjoyed it and life wasn't the same. And that's just insane to think about.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Like, I came out of, you know, this experience. So we drove down, pretty much the flooding hit like Tuesday, Wednesday, big time in Hawke's Bay. And I drove down Thursday with my brother. And the roads were just munted. We only had a two-wheel drive ute to get out to central Hawke's Bay. So, yeah. I mean, the main state highways were okay, but getting out to the place where the family was a bit of a mission. But then when we got there, it was like, yeah, let's get to work. You know, we divvied out the tasks and we just got to it. And I don't know, that yeah, there was something really quite rewarding about seeing the work be done, saving the house, saving the stuff that was there. Because it's like, man, relying on... I mean, insurance will eventually pay out, but who knows how many months that's going to take. And if Christchurch is anything to learn from, you know, it could be 6 months before you see any of that claims get processed. So taking it into your own hands, and that was sort of like the self-sovereign aspect. So you can see I'm sort of weaving a Bitcoin into this story, but it's like we were self-sovereign. We got in, we did the work, we tried to recover as much as we could, we saved the house, and we learned a bit around value as well, you know. And it's like no amount of money could have brought any of, you know, having a generator, it like that's worth gold. It's weight in gold, because, you know, there was people, then there's still people today in Napier and that still haven't got power. And you realize, like, ultimately money is a promise for, you know, a promise for something. And that something needs, the thing that actually is the things like food, water, shelter, these actual basics, right? And it's only when you're in these emergency situations that you realize that. But if you go to other countries where they're often sort of living on the edge, that for them is the daily life, their daily bread. You know, value is measured in bushels of corn, or, you know, kgs of rice or whatever. That's value, because that's food, that's life. And the way we measure that with fiat is like, I don't know, it's like so abstracted away.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know, it's just a thought experiment. Yeah.
Bitcoin's definitely closer to reality than the abstract of fear. I feel it's more representative of that. I mean, it's no nature, but it's more true, like taking out that peer-to-peer value exchange. I mean, that's what it's got in common, I guess, really, when you barter and trade with somebody goods for goods. And now you can transact peer-to-peer with Bitcoin value directly with them. It really reduces that abstract nature, I guess.
Well, this is interesting, because circling back to a conversation we had earlier around cash and my New Year's resolution to use cash, this is literally, a case study for that, which was, I mean, the power was out in a lot of places, but just where my family were, I mean, there were no shops. I mean, it's the countryside. There's nowhere to spend money. And in that sense, you realize it's like, yeah, in a natural disaster situation, the ultimate store of value is what you can immediately use to survive. And that is like real goods and real things, you know. And I think that's not something I sort of picked up on, I think, with our discussion. I was sort of like still thinking, well, you know, you're going to use money. But it's like, yeah, when everything's flooded out, money doesn't even work. Like, who do you pay to get someone in? You know, if there's an emergency and buildings are falling over and there's a flood, FBOS paper money doesn't matter. Even Bitcoin in that moment doesn't matter. What matters is survival. But then when you do sort of start rebuilding and you're back to, you know, a stable position, then at that point, the Bitcoin that you've got locked away that's sitting there on the blockchain for you is available for you. And it just maintains its store of value. I don't know, it's just new ways of looking at value and what you see around you, I find interesting.
No, that is interesting.
Yeah, it needs more thought. I'm just sort of ideating on it. I'm keen to talk to a few people. I've got a few interviews lined up with, I would say, rural type people.
Nice.
And I would like to explore this concept further, because I just find, I don't know if you've found it, but they just are a lot more receptive. And certainly I can, my own background, it's a lot easier to, I think, understand when you come from that world.
It does make sense. And yeah, I had some good chats with that guy, that gentleman at the meetup, and I got that coming through, because I hadn't actually really talked to anyone rural. I'd seen the sort of the swell overseas of Beef Initiative and Shake a Rancher's Hand and all these kind of things that you see them doing. And I could see how they were being introduced to Bitcoin for the first time and really getting it quickly.
Yeah.
And so there is something there. It'll be interesting to see that in New Zealand. I know there's some chat, Texas Slim and Babes Who Bitcoin on Twitter. I think they're in Australia right now and coming to New Zealand or something.
Yeah.
And they've been talking about it, so it's pretty cool to see something rolling out. And there's that other crew in Australia have been talking a lot about it lately. So there's some things happening in Australia, not so much in New Zealand, but I think it'll naturally flow if there really is something there, which it seems that there is. Yeah. That will come next, the rural New Zealand. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it works, and absolutely in communities, and also for iwi. You know, a lot of these exchanges that take place, as I said, you know, things like firewood or meat or these other kind of commodity type exchanges, which are, you know, an informal economy. Things like Bitcoin also work really well, you know, in those situations, because you're doing it in a direct way. It's self-sovereign, it's peer-to-peer. You're not involving, you know, some third party. I don't know. It just feels a lot more true to the spirit of New Zealand's kind of pioneer kind of roots, you know?
Yeah, I definitely support all that. And we're certainly keen to push as much peer-to-peer alternative network sort of transacting as we can. Like, for example, the Bitcoin magazine at the meetup, like, we purchased them with Bitcoin, we sold them with Bitcoin. So anyone who purchased one of those magazines at the meetup can safely know that the entire supply chain of getting this magazine to them was on an alternative monetary network without a middleman. And it doesn't have to be the way that it is in the world. Like, you can really do this. So it's really cool.
Just changing tacks a little bit. So I had a conversation today with another Bitcoin project that I'm involved in, looking at KYC and AML. So know your customer, anti-money laundering regulations and requirements, which are pretty common. You know, anyone who's ever signed up for an online service where you have to give your ID or take a photo of your passport or something. That's all KYC. And I was talking to a company today who provide that as pretty much a service. Just sort of seeing how we could perhaps integrate that or automate that process, because it's quite a stringent requirement. And I tell you, man, I just felt this heaviness in my gut, because I was quite naive to it, to be honest. Like before the phone call, I was like, yeah, sweet, you know, it's not a major. But understanding exactly what is involved and how much information they track and how much they hold, really, I felt just this strong sense of disgust and just blown away. And so, for example, when you submit your ID and your identifying information, they run all these various checks. So, you know, you think you're just sending your ID, but they're actually running it against the database. And so they've got things like politically exposed people. They do an adverse media check, which is where they look up your name in the media and see if there's any negative media that comes out. They have an algorithm that checks for that. They've got a whole bunch of automatic checks around, like, different records that different organizations would have on, you know, have on file, and just the whole thing. But the way we were being pitched it, because we were sort of coming into it as a kind of curious about this as a service that we could perhaps integrate with, it was like we were being kind of pitched it, and it was so normalized the way they were talking about it. But I was like, man, this is absolutely phenomenal how much information's been captured.
So they're doing all these things just so you can participate in the monetary network.
Yeah, well, wow. Whatever the service is that you're wanting to sign up for would then integrate with this organizer, this, you know, and there's many of these providers out there to run your details, kind of, you know, offload that data to these people who would check it against all of their databases and sources and basically give you a tick or a cross whether you're a legit person that can be given these services. And if it's a cross, you know, whether it's something you said online or some piece of media that was negative about you, then there's like further investigation. I'm probably not giving you the full picture of it, because I was in shock actually at how much, you know, because I guess you would say I was KYC naive as of like 6 hours ago, but having had the phone call, seeing just how much they've got and how easy it is for it to be abused. Like, if you're the operator of the, so, you know, you're running a company, you integrate with the service. Anyone in your company who has access to log into the dashboard can see every passport, driver's license, personal record that's been uploaded. You know, there's just like a little thing. You click it and you can see the passport that was uploaded, the biometrics, the face, you know, take a photo of your face and holding your ID up. It's all there. You can just screenshot it, download it. And what happens if someone logs into that? You know, your password gets stolen. It's all there.
And that then, is something that's striking me lately, is the amount of organizations holding sensitive data, and you're just beholden to that. If you had to provide something to be able to participate in their service, then you're just entrusting them with this data of yourself. And you just hear stories every other day of something that got hacked and you've lost all this. And privacy breaches, data leaks, just it's ongoing. And that's why I think we're now with this Nostra as well, like we're starting to see protocols overtake these kinds of things. So we had, everybody had their own server, then we outsourced it all to the cloud. I think we're going to see it all come back and operate through protocols and perhaps many more things than we can imagine, because it just seems to be the best way. You hold those keys, you're in charge of your own data, and that's how it seems like a great solution to all this. Carry on.
Honestly, I had to just talk to someone about this. I had to go for a walk, actually. Like, that's how just intense it was, because we were being pitched this, and it was like a sales pitch, you know, because we were a potential client to using the service, not that we're going to, but, and it was like, wow, this is so normalized, in the same way that IBM or whoever provided typewriters to the concentration camps, you know, they're like, oh, it's just business, you know, like, and I realize, and you see what's going on in China, which is even more, like, that's another notch up. But it's like, man, this is unacceptable. And you don't see it. Like, you would never know that this was a thing, because all you see is, oh, I submit my ID. That doesn't really do anything. But if you look at all of the databases that it's going into on the back end, all of the checks that are being run, like, did you know that any transaction over $1,000 New Zealand internationally gets sent straight into a database and is recorded against your name? Any transaction within New Zealand over $10,000 is also recorded as, you know, in a special in a special database.
They're trying to lower all these numbers as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, I thought I saw something in the US where they were trying to put forward a bill for $600.
And it's going to converge on the CBDC, right? And that's
kind of, they've got easy access to all that
data. It's all there. Yeah. So that was my kind of rebuttal to, I still think there's a lot of work for everyone to do, but wow, seeing it and being pitched it in such a way, I was quite blown away. But then you go out and you see how Bitcoin just works. It's easy. Goodness emerges. People are just doing the thing that they need to do. It's like, none of this stuff is for our protection. It's not to stop money laundering. All of it is to control, because money laundering still takes place. And it's actually the banks who facilitate it. And it's like, when you start to think like that, it's like, yeah, you can see just how it's like literally clown world, black is white, up is down, left is right.
Well, it's one of those weird things, because to produce a system like that, you've had many, many, many people involved performing a little step along the way of that system. And I would assume that almost all, if not all, of those people would not have the thought that they're trying to control anything. They're just doing their part, their job.
Just doing their job, yeah.
Yeah, and they're like, well, you know, maybe if we do this, less people get ripped off, or they genuinely think that this is serving some good. But that's the collective. End up in this place,
yeah.
But nobody in that process has an intention of going to this place, but this is where it goes. Like, and that's why we need self-sovereignty. But that's also why Bitcoin will win. I mean, I don't think we actually have the same viewpoint on this, but I'm very relaxed in the view that Bitcoin is a complete inevitability. I feel no urgency to fight some forces to make it help Bitcoin win. Like, talking with Rob of Accept Bitcoin is excellent, because I like his viewpoint of, he's working really hard at it because we can speed it up. But I don't think we're needed to make it happen. I'm very comfortable and of the viewpoint that Bitcoin is going to be the world's store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account, all the rest of it, everything, I feel. And it's just a matter of time. And so when I hear these things, I actually feel quite good, because they're just all reasons why Bitcoin will win. There's just too much cost, too much barrier in the existing fiat system that Bitcoin just defeats it on every metric so easily.
Yeah, you know, I hear that. Like, I don't think, I mean, what does the future even look like, right? There's branching paths, and I think we all have, you know, free will, and we can choose what we focus on. I think I would lean towards trying to bring that time horizon closer to now. And if there's anything I can do to enable that dissemination of information and I guess building the lifeboats, as I think a lot of people see, you know, see this process as kind of bringing others on board and certainly helping people I care about to get onto this. Because there will be places who choose, because it is a choice to turn their freedom, to give away their freedom in exchange for this control. There will be people who choose that. And you can't help those people, but for the people who choose freedom, we can help them, and we have the tools available now. And it's just, even historically, it's like, who chooses to be free and who chooses to be unfree? I mean, it's a question that goes back many, many thousands of years. Because all it takes is people to stand up and do something about it. And we're so lucky in the sense that a lot of the work's been done, like, Bitcoin's there, you just got to use it.
Yep, I definitely agree. Some very brave and motivated and visionary people have stood up and done the work and standing on their shoulders a bit and
absolutely
just pushing it along and do our best to speed it up. I agree. I can't wait because it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Well, you're doing your piece as well with BitKiwi, and I think, as I said, overall I really enjoyed the meetup. I think it was really great, a lot of great conversations. I think having just a small contingent of people coming together to talk about Bitcoin, but we had people come up from Christchurch still. We had people come in from the wider DAPA. And for those people, it was like, yeah, this is the first time they've met other Bitcoiners in real life, as you say. There's something special about that moment, because you just sort of instantly click and you're like, these are my people.
Yeah, there was a new guy there. I loved it. I forget his name now, but I saw that he'd come in late, and I just, he was standing by himself. I went over and spoke to him, and he felt me out. Like, it was like he wasn't quite sure, are these people actual Bitcoiners or is this some crypto trash? Like, I think that's what he was thinking, because he says to me, do you buy Bitcoin? I said, yeah, fairly regularly, you know, just a little bit. I don't even know what the price is going to do, so I just buy a little bit occasionally and then it'll average. And he goes, oh, you mean DCA? And I was like, yeah. And then he was like, oh, sweet, I'm in the right place. Okay, this is a real Bitcoin. He was feeling me out. Are these my people?
It's interesting how the wider crypto world is also sort of, I don't know, just sort of the change, you know, crypto, right, with air quotes, but how a lot of that sort of grift has sort of just evaporated, and now it's all turning into AI grift. And there's still people who are into Ethereum, but I'm seeing, I don't know, man, just some of the stuff happening with the securities law in the US. I don't know, man. Look, it could be the end of it. I don't know if, I mean, we don't need to go into it, but I just find it curious that the death spiral of it all, which is...
I thought it would take a lot longer, but there's been a lot of developments in 2022-23 that are starting to really show people. Like, you're seeing people come around. There's someone at my work likes to dabble in this and that, now Bitcoin only.
Yeah.
You're just seeing people starting to realize that actually this is a thing. Bitcoin is really different.
This is it, yeah. No, I love it. And just also seeing with, you know, these kind of the amount of bloat, you know, that you get with something like Ethereum, and just it reminds me in a way a lot of the legacy system. Like, they're putting patches upon patches, and they're always, you know, it's this and that, and they're changing the goals, and the goalposts are moving, and it doesn't know what it is, and in a way it feels like the scramble of Ethereum mirrors the scramble of late stage fiat. Which is, okay, now we're going to do quantitative easing, we're going to do tightening, we're going to push the interest rates up on it, we're going to pull them back. we're going to move to a CBDC. Oh, we're going to, you know, there's all of these kind of postures, which they kind of, the way they talk about it, it seems like it was inevitable, but you know, they literally just made it up. It's like they're winging it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the shift to proof of stake is just, that's this, that really is the cryptocurrency version of the fiat world. Like, you're really introducing something quite similar to the Cantillon effect, where suddenly the people with the most in the Ethereum world have access,
and they get more
and privilege to the most, and it really mirrors that system. It's the antithesis of Bitcoin.
I don't know where the psychology of that came from, though. Like, how did they arrive at that? It's as if there's like no real understanding of the meta macro and kind of environment. Like, I always feel like it's as if they're looking at it as a computer software engineering problem, and they never take into account the classic human action, Austrian economics, psychology piece, you know, or even just understanding how humans work. It's like they're not exposed to that. And they're like, well, we'll just do a proof of stake and da da da. But it's like, no, that's not how it works. Like, you've literally just recreated the problem that Bitcoin set out to solve.
That's right.
I don't know, man. It's maybe it's just a way of thinking that maybe developers, you know, engineer types, that they're so in their zone and they're like, oh, well, we've got this thing that we're doing, that they can't see the broader picture. And that's why I come to appreciate just how much vision Satoshi had for not just the code, but the wider kind of the incentive structure.
Yeah, for sure. Couldn't agree more.
But anyway, look, you would be busy preparing for BitKiwi 4. Hopefully it's going to be, I'm expecting it to be a pretty big turnout. I think it's going to be good. Have you got anything else to add about that, or any other developments on the BitKiwi front?
No, not really any developments. Just, it does take a lot of work and a lot of effort to put them together.
It's worth saying as well, like, a lot of that effort, though unseen, is critical. And so I certainly appreciate it, and thank you for doing all of this, because I know just how much goes into making it so smooth and seamless.
Thanks, appreciate that, because it definitely, there is a lot going under the hood with the three of us to make these things happen, and a lot of it's just little things that you wouldn't really think about. You know, you're still like, oh, we'll get a venue and put the word out there and off we go. But, you know, like, you really, and we are quite perfectionists with a lot of little things, so we want to make sure, you know, it's going to work. Systems aren't going to fall over, and people are going to know where to go. It's nice and clear, and we really go all out to do that, and a bit of cost involved as well, but we love it, so we're just going to keep going, improving them, making them better. So nothing to really announce other than BitKiwi 4 come along, and the following month we'll be back in Wellington for BitKiwi 5 on April 29 for the North Islanders.
Yeah, sweet. All right. Yeah. Well, that's BitKiwi 4, March 25th, 2 p.m. at the Beely Quarter in Christchurch. So sounds good. All right. Well, thank you very much, BitKiwi Paul, and we'll see you in Christchurch anyway. I'm sure me and you might catch up in between now and then, but otherwise we can all touch base in Christchurch.
Awesome. Thanks for having us, Cody.
Thank you.